From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Hello, everyone. Today we return from our hiatus for the summer, and we begin our regular programming schedule with a report from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Stephen Sefton, from Managua, Nicaragua. Stephen, welcome back. It's been a long summer up here in New York, and I'm certain you have a lot to report on in terms of what's been happening in Central and South America and the Caribbean. Maybe we could start with where you're situate in Nicaragua.
Yeah, and it's good to be back and talking to you again, Don. There's been so much happening over the last few months, and quite radical changes in regional terms, especially in terms of what we've been talking about for years, the developing processes of integration and how United States intervention, along with its local proxies, seeks to stymie, at least neutralize, those moves to regional integration using a progressive agenda. A lot has happened in relation to that while we've been in hiatus, as it were, as regards our conversations. But the main thing, probably, I think most people in Latin America and the Caribbean would agree that the main thing that hangs over the region at the moment is the continuing effects of the outbreak of COVID-19.
Yeah, like the rest of the world, the same thing, yeah.
So here in Nicaragua, our experience has been quite a little bit different to other countries, and that may have to do with the demographics of the country, because it's a primarily rural country, and although it has a couple of big urban centers in Managua and León, most people among the general population have quite outdoor lives, and so they don't spend their lives in air-conditioned offices, for
or
example.
Cooped up in the subway with a thousand other people packed into the same car or whatever. It's more social distancing is a part of the normal, intercourse among people there.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that here in Nicaragua, most of us have been the beneficiaries of that kind of demographic reality. That we spend most of our lives out in the open air,
right,
out in the sunshine, and an excellent source of vitamin D. And so the reality here has been a little bit different quite a bit different to what it would be in Northern Europe or in the Northern United States, for example.
Right.
Or even in somewhere like Florida, where people spend all their times in, most people spend their time inside in apartments or in offices with air conditioning and so on.
Right.
So our experience here in Nicaragua has been a little bit different, but and I think it's also fair to say that the Nicaraguan authorities liaised much more closely with the international health organizations like the World Health Organization and the Pan American Health Organization right from the start. It's almost like ancient history now, but when you go back to the beginning of the outbreak of the COVID-19 outbreak back in January of 2020, it was at the end of January that the World Health Organization started issuing alerts, and that was when the Nicaraguan authorities instituted their public health plan to address what was predicted to be a very serious pandemic with a very serious disease that could cause widespread fatalities, and that was that was what it looked like back then in January. So it's perfectly reasonable of governments everywhere to take measures that they wouldn't take in normal times, and here in Nicaragua, that what the government did was it prepared its hospitals, it set aside 19 hospitals out of the 70 plus hospitals that exist in Nicaragua's public health system. Nicaragua has more public health hospitals than any other country in Central America.
Right.
And they set aside 19 of those with specialized staff to deal with potential patients suffering from an infection by COVID-19. They also engaged in massive house-to-house educational and monitoring visits. They made something like, Nicaragua's population is about 6.5 million.
Yeah.
And they made a total of over 5 million house visits to households, mainly in urban areas, but also in semi-urban areas as well.
Wow.
Using a team of around, I think it was a total of 35,000 volunteer health promoters and health professionals from the public health system. So they were able to monitor very closely the development of any cases in especially in urban communities. And they also instituted very strict measures controlling travelers, and they did rigorous contact tracing of people who came into the country who had some kind of fever. But everything here in Nicaragua has been voluntary. And people were asked to quarantine on a voluntary basis, and almost everybody did. Very few people resisted that request from the authorities. And in general, everything that's been done has been on the basis of voluntary cooperation rather than coercion. And I think that's a fundamental difference between the approach that Nicaragua has taken and the approach that countries elsewhere have taken, in particular in Europe and North America, and
right.
Notoriously in Australia.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting difference here in Nicaragua. And in terms of success, the main measure people seem to agree on in terms of gauging the severity of the incidence of COVID-19 in any given country seems to be using excess mortality as an indicator.
Right.
And here in Nicaragua, a study was done in a prestigious university in Washington. They did a statistical study of excess mortality in Nicaragua through last year. And the study found that Nicaragua had the lowest excess mortality of any of the countries in, certainly in Latin America and the Caribbean.
Mm. That's a pretty impressive. And for people that don't know, I mean, you're near the equator, it's a jungle out there, as they say. It's very, there's actual jungle. So you have diseases that are associated with the tropical, environment, such as dengue and malaria and such. Sort of, they're kind of common, much more common than they are, say, in New York.
And, oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And so that's kind of a backdrop to all of this, too.
Oh, yeah. And every year in Nicaragua, the hospitals get fill up with, during the rainy season, they fill up with cases, as you say, of dengue, of all kinds of viral infections, including influenza, different kinds of influenza,
right.
Different kinds of viral infections. Leptospirosis is common because of the rodent population in both urban and rural areas. And it's not very common, but it's not uncommon.
Right.
Dengue is very common. I had dengue this year, and the symptoms are very similar. Some of the symptoms are very similar to COVID-19. So whenever anybody gets a viral infection now, and I'm sure it's the same in the United States and Europe and elsewhere, whenever anybody gets a viral infection, they think, I've got COVID. I might have COVID. And so they get very wound up about that. But the fact is that here in Nicaragua, for example, before we began recording, I mentioned to you that last year here on the community projects, where we have something over 40 people working on the different community projects here, including our
right.
education program.
Right.
And the only person that got sick with COVID with us last year was our school director. And she was seriously ill. She was in hospital for 4 days in intensive care.
Mm.
But she got over the infection, and the main effect in her case was fear. She was absolutely terrified by the experience.
Mm.
And as I was explaining to you, we had to help her with about, over a period of about 4 months, with weekly visits from a psychologist to help her overcome the emotional trauma of the infection that she suffered.
So now, there was the longest effect, the longest lasting effect she had was the fear that's been, you know, perpetuated throughout the media around the globe, the impact of that on her from getting sick rather than the virus.
Right. And so this year, I've no idea whether it's some variant or other, but we've had a slightly different experience this year, because over the last month or so, and right through the first semester, we had no incidence of COVID-19 at all. And then through August, we had half a dozen cases of people who were diagnosed with COVID among the people working on our community programs. But they all had the equivalent of what seemed like quite severe flu symptoms. They all recovered, and they've all made a very good recovery, including somebody who is in remission for cancer of the liver.
Wow. So, right, somebody compromised.
Yeah, so and that's been our experience. So our experience of COVID has been, and in terms of vaccinations, and insofar as it's appropriate to use the term vaccination, because
it's not
clear by any means what is the state of, a lot of these vaccines don't provide immunity.
Right.
And apparently there are a significant number of cases in North America and Europe of people who've been fully vaccinated but still develop the disease. So which makes you question, well, what is the logic of these mass vaccination programs? I mean, perhaps people will argue that the main benefit is that they reduce the number of people that get infected, and they reduce the level of severity of the infection. Well, we'll see eventually. I'm sure that in a year or so's time, we'll have much better data on which to kind of discuss the whole issue. But in terms of vaccinations here, Nicaragua, like many developing countries, has had difficulty getting access to vaccines. The Russian Federation has donated a large number of the Sputnik V vaccine. India donated a large number of the what they call the Covishield vaccine, which, as I understand it, is the AstraZeneca vaccine, but produced in India. And the government has used those vaccines to prioritize chronically ill people, vulnerable people, people at risk from existing health conditions, and also frontline healthcare workers, patients all the time. So that's right. And they vaccinated, and I think they're getting up to 10% of the population now.
So 10% of the population, and what about the excess death thing? I just want to get a comparison, like, of, you know, here's the input, and what's the output?
Well, and the excess deaths are minimal, and the official figures, and we personally, I take the official figures as gospel by any means, but they reckon that they have five or six deaths a month. Currently, there are out of this population of 6.5 million, there are around 580 positive cases of COVID. I mean, I think that's a reliable figure if you can trust the PCR test at all.
So the
number of deaths is running at, whereas last year in June, July, there were probably 40 to 50 deaths a month attributed to the COVID-19 virus. This year, there are kind of 6 to 10 deaths a month attributed to the virus, something like that.
So that's like 1 in a million, literally.
Yeah, and it's kind of a month, yeah.
Yeah, per month, wow.
So in terms of the impact on normal life here has been practically zero. And we if you go to the supermarket, you have to wear a mask, and they take your temperature with a digital thermometer. Mm-hmm. And if you go into an office, any public office or a bank or that kind of institution, you're obliged to wear a mask. But outside, very few people wear masks, and that fluctuates from from one month to the next, when there's a general sense out in the population that there are more infections than there were last month, then you see more people wearing masks. And then as people get more blasé, you see fewer people wearing masks. So, but the important thing to note in Nicaragua's case is that none of this is coercive.
Right.
Except if you go into a supermarket.
Right, a social setting, that's a different matter. Yeah. Right. Well, you know, that's epidemiology. I mean, one of the ways you stop something that's communicable from being communicated is by cutting down the opportunities. And that's what you do when you make people wear masks indoors when they're close to each other. There's a whole mindset here. You see people driving around in their own car with the windows up wearing masks.
Right.
That's a little bit over the top, you know, just in terms of thinking the science through that. Unless somebody sneezed in the air where you were driving a half an hour ago, loaded with COVID, and somehow it makes its way into your car and down your throat and reproduces, I mean, it's really a one in a million chance, because that seems like that's what happens without going crazy.
Yeah, and I think although our neighboring countries have slightly different experiences, because Honduras and El Salvador traditionally much more repressive societies than here in Nicaragua.
Right.
And so they last year in particular, they imposed extremely coercive restrictive measures. But Nicaragua's experience was much better than that of neighboring countries, including Costa Rica and Guatemala.
Right.
And so, but even in those countries, it looks as though the level of mortality resulting from the COVID-19 virus is much less than it was last year. So, you know, and they still have restrictions, but the situation generally in Central America seems to be much more positive than it was last year. For my part, I tend to be a COVID-19 skeptic, partly because of the relatively benign experience that we've had here in Nicaragua.
Right. And plus, again, you guys are used to dealing with these kinds of epidemics, not so communicable as this. This is like a flu kind of, you can catch it, you know, close up from people sneezing in the air or whatever, apparently. But, you know, you have outbreaks of dengue or, you know, of malaria or whatever, other, you know, diseases like that on a seasonal basis. Some you have bad years, some good years, and you know, like, well, it's dengue season or whatever, and people adjust. This is not a new phenomenon to people living where you're living.
Yeah, and I think that's largely true, Don. And I think initially, in the first semester of last year, there was much more paranoia among the general population, largely as a result of what they were reading about events in North America and Europe, and what they were hearing from relatives who had migrated to work in Spain, for example, or in the United States. And so there was a lot of information coming into Nicaragua through those informal channels, as well as the incredible psychological scare campaign that was mobilized in mainstream media in particular.
Yeah. Still going on here, too, by the way.
Right.
On a daily basis. If you watch television, you start checking every time you clear your throat or whatever. It's like, oh, my God, do I have it?
Yeah. So anyway, in relation to that, in relation to the distortions in the psychological warfare that's applied to populations, I think the other thing that we were hoping to be able to cover, I don't know if it's if we're going to have time, but I was hoping to be able to talk about the double standards that are applied.
Sure, we do. We absolutely have time.
Yeah. So in the case of Nicaragua, what's happened in mainstream media in North America and Europe is that in relation to the COVID-19 outbreak, Nicaragua has been subject to all kinds of distortions and misrepresentations that give a completely misleading idea about the reality here in relation to the infection. And most people will be reading mainstream media or even alternative media, and they'll come away with the conclusion that the government is rigging the data and that Nicaragua has suffered a public health crisis, and the opposite is the case. And that's true in other areas as well. I'm talking about Nicaragua in particular. At the moment, Nicaragua is the victim of a disinformation campaign about measures that it has taken under its criminal code against people who were involved in trying to destabilize or planning to destabilize the elections that are due in later this year in November. In a way, it is incredible in a way the completely shameless way in which the United States authorities tell you what they're going to do. Here in Nicaragua, for example, last July, a USAID document came to light. It was called Responsive Assistance in Nicaragua, RAIN, the RAIN document. And it was a USAID document setting out plans to destabilize the government and try to arrange for a government of transition in the run-up to, during, and after the November elections. Mm-mm-mm. And they're absolutely blatant, and they set out what they were going to do, and so, given the fact that the United States is openly explaining how it hopes to destabilize the election process, the government it started investigating U.S. government collaborators here in Nicaragua, including most notoriously Cristiana Chamorro, the Chamorro family in general.
Right.
Who are the local oligarchs.
Yeah, here. From Violeta Chamorro's family, yes. Yeah,
so and they run a very well-known foundation called the Violeta Chamorro Foundation. And from 2017 to date, that foundation, or 2018 to date, that foundation had received around $7 million that they couldn't account for from USAID, from the International Republican Institute, from the National Endowment for Democracy, the National Democrat Institute.
Your tax dollars at work, Americans.
So, and then when they got investigated, because they're a non-profit.
Right.
So they were investigated, and it was found that they'd been engaging in outright fraud, money laundering, dishonest use of the funds that they'd received for non-profit purposes, and other people associated with similar foundations were also investigated, and a lot of these people were people who had openly called for U.S. intervention in Nicaragua, called for the imposition of sanctions, economic sanctions against Nicaragua.
Right.
And under Nicaragua's criminal code, that kind of behavior is a criminal treasonous offense.
This is, by the way, what Trump, who was president of the United States, was accused of, and they tried to remove him from office twice with this as the backdrop, and they're still talking about prosecuting him criminally. So for the average person on the ground somewhere else is getting no more persecuted for sure than the Americans do on a regular basis, even to the most powerful person here.
Right. So, and is that Russiagate that you're referring to?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, and so you have, and so what, but what the way that's reported in the mainstream media is always, this is a crackdown on presidential candidates.
You know, they have another game going on in the media here, too, with Nicaragua. I'm looking at the New York Times, and all I did was search term Nicaragua COVID at the New York Times website. Here's the first two hits, July 18th, 2020. Nicaragua's ruling Sandinistas fall victim to COVID-19, highlighting the disease's spread. The haphazard, politicized response to the pandemic by the country's leaders has put the government's own officials and supporters at particular risk. And then the next day in the print edition, After playing down COVID-19 risk, Sandinista party officials are dying. That's a year ago.
Yeah, and it's certainly true that the members of the FSLN were dying, but everybody was dying, across the general population. And there were a significant number of fatalities from the virus. And it's only logical that
some of them, right.
The virus doesn't say, show me your party card. Right?
Exactly. Yep, that's right. Yeah. Not for nothing, by the way, unlike in the United States, where most of the people in Congress, say, or whatever, belong to their own country clubs, so they don't really rub elbows in the subway with most of us most of the time. Nicaragua's government is of and among the people, so if the people catch cold, they catch cold.
Right. So, yeah, and that's just typical disinformation from the New York Times. And going back to what we were saying, if you compare the mainstream media coverage of the events here in Nicaragua with what's going on, for example, in El Salvador. In El Salvador, Nayib Bukele, the president there, who had a very successful win in the legislative elections for his political party. He's taken over the constitutional court. He's taken over the public prosecutor, which in Central American countries, the public prosecutor is normally an independent of the government. And early in the year before the elections, he invaded the legislature with soldiers, trying to intimidate them from engaging in procedures that he wasn't happy with.
Wow.
But none of that gets reported. Of course none of that gets reported in mainstream media. Of course it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Or if it does get reported, it gets reported as in low-key terms.
Yeah, certainly no one says, hey, he did exactly what the U.S.-backed coup in Ukraine did with the Rada.
Right.
He sent soldiers in and took out the people he didn't like at gunpoint.
Right. Yeah, and it didn't quite come to the Ukrainian extreme in El Salvador, but it wasn't far off. And then, as a result of the elections, there was a lot of controversy around the electoral process in El Salvador. Not that you'd know from reading mainstream or alternative media very much. So then, as a result of those elections, Bukele is now in a much stronger position, and he's abusing his majority in the legislature to push through all kinds of constitutional changes that he would otherwise not be able to do. And I just saw a headline today that he's now changed El Salvador's constitution so that he can get reelected.
Yeah.
And there's been no, so far as I can see, there's been no outcry about that. Whereas,
right.
In the case, similarly, I mean, a similar thing happened in Costa Rica in the time of that guy, Oscar Arias. He got a decision in the Supreme Court so that he could get reelected. Álvaro Uribe did the same thing in Colombia some years ago. But those kinds of developments never get criticized in mainstream media.
Hey, there's one I could tell you about right in West Africa that never even got reported here, which is when the French sent in their own troops to remove the just recently reelected president, Laurent Gbagbo, from the presidential palace at gunpoint in front of photographs. We have to end here. We're out of time. I really enjoyed speaking with you, and we will speak with you again next week. Stephen Sefton in Esteli, near Managua, Nicaragua.
Thanks a lot, Tony. It's good to talk to you again. Take care now.
The same, you too.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.